going to get started. My name is DeWitt Peart. I'm the CEO of the Downtown Austin Alliance. We appreciate everyone's participation. We're going to start off with a prayer. Senior Pastor Catherine Barlow-Williams from Central Presbyterian is going to lead us off on a short prayer to start. Thanks.
Thank you so much, and don't be nervous if you're not the praying type. This is going to include everybody. I just wanted to welcome everyone. We're so thrilled you're here tonight. Central Presbyterian Church has been on this corner, at least a presence in downtown Austin, for almost 180 years. And it is our great honor to be at the crossroads between... Thank you. The crossroads of people who are neighbors that we call our people who we call our neighbors. Some have homes and some live in penthouses. And yet God calls us to this little corner of the world to try to reveal love and hope for all. Our goal is to help those without homes find homes and have a place to sleep at night. We believe that to whom much is given, much is expected. If you are interested in learning about our programs for the homeless, you can see me afterwards. I have business cards here. We have lots of work to do and lots of great, fulfilling, wonderful work. And with that, we're not going to do like a formal prayer, but I know many of you have come from busy days and have been hectic trying to get here. So something I learned long ago, you don't have to lift up your hands if you don't want to, but just up and in with the good, all the goodness, love, and hope you can reach for, and then out with the bad. In with the good. Anybody wants to do it with me? Let's go. Don't hit your neighbors. That would be a bad start to the meeting. In with the good. Out with the bad. Thank you. In the name of love for God, for everyone here, we're grateful to be here, and we hope tonight brings goodness and solutions and resolutions.
Thank you. This evening is not a City of Austin sponsored event, and thus it is not a public hearing or official town hall meeting. The purpose tonight is to allow you to listen to three of our city's most notable experts in their respective fields. Please note that our panelists today are not policymakers. They are working through the results of the changes to the ordinances related to homelessness, but they are not responsible for those changes. There's been a lot of concern from businesses and residents downtown about the changes in the city's ordinances. There have been very few opportunities for the business owners and residents to hear about these changes and to have the opportunity to ask questions. We hope and expect that the City of Austin will host its own public forums that will be more typical of a public town hall meeting. That's not tonight's structure. The main purpose tonight is to hear from these three experts. We are honored to have Dean Angela Evans of the LBJ School to act as our moderator. More about Dean Evans in a moment. We're going to give most of tonight's time to the panel with questions from the dean. We will not be taking verbal questions from the audiences, but we are collecting cards, so please submit your questions in that manner. The cards are available at the registration table if you haven't already filled one out. During the last 15 minutes of this forum, we'll pose selected questions from the cards we receive. We will be concluding the program this evening promptly at 6:30, but we'll leave time for the media interviews afterwards. Tonight is not intended to be a public debate, argument, or opportunity for advocacy. Thus, we urge civility, respect, and quiet. Before I introduce our moderator, I would like to take a moment to acknowledge Chief Brian Manley and the Austin Police Department for the work they do every day to keep downtown in our city one of the safest in the country. The police are frequently called upon to address issues of public safety involving people experiencing homelessness. We appreciate Chief Manley's leadership, and we are grateful for the men and women of the department who are called upon every day to navigate many difficult issues, and who do so professionally and with compassion. Please join me in expressing our appreciation for these men and women of APD. I would also like to recognize Councilmember Kathy Tova, who has joined us. Kathy's in the front row here, so thank you, Councilmember, for joining us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Dean Angela Evans, who is the esteemed dean of the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. Dean Evans has led the LBJ School since 2016 and is professor of public policy. Prior to being dean of the LBJ School of Public Affairs, she spent 40 years in public service to the U.S. Congress. Dean Evans, thanks so much for being here and for leading this forum. Thank you.
Thank you, Dee, and thanks for all of you to be here tonight. This is going to be an important discussion. And the reason why I really believe in this type of thing is because at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, where we're trying to train the next generation of people to get into public policy, as well as my previous life with the U.S. Congress, it's really important. Four things are really important when you're dealing with public policy. One is to understand what the real problem is. If you get the problem wrong, you get the solutions wrong. Two, that the problems have to be defined by evidence and data. If you make decisions without that, then you're leaving yourself open to mistakes. Three, the solutions that you choose should be feasible, should be something that you can implement. And four, all policy can be amended. So once you have implementation and you think about that implementation and how that implementation works or doesn't work, you bring it back to how you define policy in the future. So that's one thing. What's one of the reasons why I really believe in this forum and this ability to talk to the community about things. The other thing that's really important about public policy, and I don't have to tell you this, when you have public policy that reaches a city level, a state level, a national level, that means problems couldn't be resolved at a level below that. So these are not easy answers. There's a lot of tensions here, and our country is based on tensions. You know, it's individual rights versus public safety, public good. These are things we deal with all the time. So this is not new. Austin's a very strong community. We've got wonderful people here. We've got wonderful people on the panel. And so we should all be proud that we are able to talk and, you know, solve these problems together. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate that. So with that, I'm going to introduce the panel. I don't think they need a lot of introduction, but I'm going to introduce them anyway. So this is Chief Brian Manley. Everybody knows him. And the chief has been with the Austin Police Department since 1990. He served as interim police chief, and then he was made last year the permanent chief. Everybody was very excited about that choice. And just recently I found out that you were named in Fortune 500's 49th top leader in the world. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So, congratulations on that. Also, his colleagues, I want to recognize Assistant Chief Justin Newson, who's sitting right here, and also the Austin Police Department's downtown district reps, and we have some folks here. Please stand up so people see who you are. It's also my pleasure to introduce you to Veronica Briceño, who's an LBJ alum, by the way. And she's currently, I just talked to her in backstage, and she's interim homeless strategy officer, but she was recently named economic development officer. She's in transition, but she's been working with the city in a lot of different capacities, small and minority businesses. She's worked for councilmen in their office. She's worked for the city manager. She's got a very rich background in this, and she's very devoted to this problem. Last but not least is Bill Bryce, and he's the Vice President of Investor Relations for Downtown Austin Alliance and has been with the Alliance since 2003. And under Bill's leadership, the Downtown Alliance has been working to help address homelessness for 15 years. They've been involved. If you really get into what they're doing a lot of volunteer work. They have wonderful ambassadors who've been partners with the city and with the police department and with other nonprofits. So we have a really great group of people here. So I want you to give them all a round of applause before we start. So what I thought I'd do is start the question sort of an icebreaker this way, which is I'm going to give each of them about 5 minutes to tell us what they would do, what kind of perceptions or myths that they want to dispel before we start in terms of both those who are experiencing homelessness from their perspective and also from their perspective of how they interact with the homeless. So we're going to start with Chief Manley.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for coming out to talk about, obviously, a very important issue to our whole community, one that the police department definitely plays a role, but I think, obviously, many other departments and a whole community plays a role here as well. I'll talk. I know you've got a lot of questions. They're going to get a lot of the information out, but there's been a lot said on this issue since these ordinances were changed. One only needs to look at social media for 20 minutes to see the extremes that people are at one end or the other. And I just believe in putting out the accurate information as it comes really to the police department. And these were things we talked about during the council meetings about what the ordinance both would do if they were changed and then what they would not do. I'll go into the specifics as the questions come out, but the ordinances did not impact the police department's ability to engage with individuals whose conduct is threatening hazard or danger to somebody else, or who their conduct is making public space impassable, obstructed. It really, the change was our ability to work in areas where we had had great success in quality of life issues, calls we would get from individuals that were camping in front of a business, sitting and lying in front of a business, sleeping in a public space, and our ability to go in and interact with those individuals, and as I'll talk about later, the specific numbers, to talk about the success that we had in getting people to change that behavior voluntarily. I think there's been a lot of discussion about the number of arrests that were being made of homeless individuals and how this impacted their ability to get future housing. And the numbers don't show that. For the past couple of years, we had a significant decrease in the arrests of homeless individuals. I believe the year leading up to the change, it was in double digits. We had gone to a more robust cite and release program where we would cite an offender and then they would be released at the scene. But again, a lot of what we did didn't even involve either of those actions. Instead, it was voluntary compliance. There's also been discussion about our interaction with the homeless individuals and all the work that our officers have done to help the homeless community. And that will continue. If an officer is on patrol or gets called to a scene and we come across a homeless individual that is in need of some type of medical assistance or mental health assistance, we're going to assist just like we did prior to the ordinances. The big change for us is our ability to interact in instances that do not meet that threshold of hazardous or dangerous. And so that's probably been the biggest change. And at the end of the day, we recognize that we are dealing with human beings here, human beings who we have sworn to protect and serve just like the rest of our community, and they have just found themselves for one reason or another in the circumstance that they're in. And so we will continue to provide services as we can to them, but also to uphold our responsibilities for public safety here in Austin. So I think I'll probably just leave my opening comments at that because I know you've got a lot of questions that'll root out a lot of the specifics.
Are not experiences that are foreign to us in our own lives. It could be the loss of a job. It could be not being able to afford your rent because it increased. It could be a divorce. It could be domestic violence and so forth. And many of these things are what we experience in our own lives. And often it happens to an individual who loses their home as a result. So I think as we're looking at our answers and our solutions and what we as a community, the city of Austin and the greater Austin community, provide as solutions, we need to keep that in mind. As we're looking at the people that we are trying to serve and to help, we need to reach out, work with them in a compassionate manner, but in a thoughtful and meaningful way, too, so that we're providing solutions that go to the data and so forth and provide the resources that we need for our most vulnerable of our community.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I think it's important to recognize a couple of things. One is that, to Veronica's point, this is about people experiencing homelessness, people that have, in many cases, a number of different issues affecting them, including poverty, potentially mental illness, substance abuse, and other factors. It's also important to note that we cannot enforce the way because we are extremely involved in a lot of different efforts to try and solve the issue of homelessness, while at the same time to maintain a safe, welcoming, and clean downtown. So we kind of play it down the middle and have our hands in a lot of sides of this issue. It's unfortunate that a lot of what we see manifesting every day downtown, right front center on Congress Avenue with Main and Main, sometimes I think taints our perceptions of what people experiencing homelessness are or are like. I can tell you that not all people experiencing homelessness have mental illness or substance abuse addictions. Many do. A lot of people want help. A lot of people don't know where to turn for that help. We have funded research that demonstrates that people don't know where to go for the services they need. And when the only answer that we have, or that the police department has, is go to ARCH, that's not an effective answer or solution. There are many actions and activities underway. We applaud the city council for the steps that they've taken to prioritize homelessness as a top strategic priority. It's also a top strategic priority of the Downtown Austin Alliance to broadly address the needs of people experiencing homelessness and mitigate the negative impacts of that downtown. But I think that it's important for all of us to be mindful of the fact that to address this problem requires a unified community. We all want downtown to be safe and welcoming for everyone. But we can't lose sight of the real target, and that is trying to address the problem. But we can't effectively do that if we're divided on this issue. So I welcome the conversation today, and thank you.
You're welcome. Chief Manley, so this is a relatively fresh new ordinance. Tell us in the first month or so of this, what your experience, what is different about your role on the street with those who are experiencing homelessness that has changed with these ordinances? Oh, sorry.
Perfect. I think I kind of alluded to it in the opening comments, and that is those instances where we can, in fact, and will, in fact, take action versus where we won't because of the changes in the ordinance. The ordinances were very specific in that the specific for sitting and lying. It is, in prior to the change, the act of sitting and lying alone in the designated area was the violation. That's all an officer needed to really understand about that before they could seek voluntary compliance or take an action. With the change in the ordinance, we now have to meet the threshold of believing and being able to show that that conduct is hazardous or dangerous, or that it is obstructing that public passageway. So what we've done is we've created an extra threshold that officers have to be able to, number one, believe is present, and then two, be able to articulate before we can take action in circumstances like that. Very similar to camping as well. Camping is still prohibited in the areas where it was before, such as designated parkland, certain city facilities that have restrictions against it, and also your private property. You have not lost any private property rights involving individuals being on your property. That would still fall under your ability to enforce what's called a criminal trespass law. But what we do now have is places where it would have been a violation just to camp alone. Now we have to, again, meet that threshold of it has to be either hazardous or dangerous, or it has to be obstructing that passageway so that it's not safe for others to either utilize that same area or for the person that's camping there. So that's that extra threshold. And then, you know, things we have to look at as well is if we're investigating a crime and the person involved in that is a homeless individual who has a tent, do we need to go get a search warrant to go into their tent to search for contraband like we would have to do for someone's private residence? So on top of just the things we're already talking about as a community, as a law enforcement agency, we actually have to go a few layers deeper to try and work into some of these other issues. And then the last ordinance, I'll talk about the what was the aggressive panhandling that now is the aggressive confrontation. That one actually didn't change in the way the other two did, and instead, prior, the aggressive conduct that that would underlie that violation had to be associated with solicitation, an act to try and acquire money or goods from somebody. Now, the aggressive acts alone are the violation. So that one is a little easier to actually utilize than it was prior because you don't have the requirement that it be tied to an act of solicitation. So that's been the big changes. What we're doing, really, we're only 3 weeks into it, so there's not enough data to really understand it yet, but we're collecting data from our officers on every time they're dispatched to a call that involves potentially one of these three ordinances, whether or not they're able to take action, and if they're not, whether they would have been able to take action prior to these ordinances being changed, so that we can truly gauge what the impact has been with these changes.
One of the things that when I was reading, and I've been reading a lot about this both in Austin and other cities, is sometimes there's a very subjective nature to having an officer make a determination. And since this is a shift and this is new, and in addition to gathering information about what they're doing, what is the police department doing to try to train, what kind of scenario planning or, you know, put people in a situation where you're trying to actually train a consistency of application of the ordinances among your officers?
So the initial thing we did was just to put out the training bulletins to explain to the officers what has changed, what the new thresholds for taking an action are. So in other words, they needed to understand what these ordinance changes now required before they would take an action. Now, as in many areas of police work, it is not black and white. There are very rarely absolutes, and that's why we have a sign that hangs at the police academy and hung there in 1990 when I went through the academy, and it says common sense and good judgment. And that's what we expect from our officers, is they understand the laws, they understand the ordinances, but again, given that we so often operate in these gray areas, we expect that they will use their experience, their training, and then again, their common sense and good judgment. So with these changes, what this has done is really put us in a position where the officer has to define that hazardous or dangerous conduct. And so that begs the question, what is hazardous or dangerous? And I could tell you that that is an individual assessment for each officer, because they'll be the one that has to go to court and testify of that conduct being hazardous or dangerous. But what we would look for is conduct that poses risk or harm or a threat of risk or harm or danger to other individuals or that person themselves. So we will continue as we work through this to try and put out more information. The community discussion is feeding a lot of this. Any actions that may be taken in the month of August or even months beyond that that pose any changes to this, then we will continue to update the training for our officers.
Thank you, Chief. I'm going to come back to you, but I want to get to Veronica. Veronica, you're in the city, and you have to implement these policies. You also have to feed that implementation back to policymakers, to the city council. Can you talk to us a little bit about the lessons that you've been gathering from other cities who've been dealing with people who are experiencing homelessness? And when we talk about this, I really like at some point to try to differentiate, because this, when we say homeless and people are experiencing homelessness, it's a broad range, like you said, of folks, some who are like one paycheck away from getting back on their feet, and those that are chronic homeless. So what are you doing in the city to try to take a lot of these experiences and cases to think about how we plan in Austin at this stage so that we avoid getting into some situations that some cities are in and maybe get to a place where some cities that are doing a better job but may not be Austin? So how are you doing this and what are you thinking about?
So we're looking closely at what other cities are doing. We're looking both within the state of Texas and beyond. We're looking for lessons learned for cities where they have larger numbers of individuals who are experiencing homelessness. We're asking them, what would you have done differently before those numbers grew so that we can learn from those lessons?
It's weird not to have to interrupt, you know, but go ahead and help.
But we're also looking at some of the best practices within our own state. Each major Texas city has an issue that they're trying to solve with homeless individuals, and they're doing it in unique ways. So what I would like to see in Austin is a collective effort of the best practices, and it could just be one simple thing from a city. For example, we have a what we're calling the Violet Bag Pilot Program. It started out in Seattle, The program includes giving purple trash bags to homeless camps, and we're working with our recycle department and recovery department to pick up those bags, and we're showing some success. But it's a very small program, but it's something that's showing some success, and what I'd like to see as we're looking on the broader band of what cities are doing, let's take what works in one city, and it may not be their whole answer to what they're doing in their city, and apply it here.
So one of the things that, you know, I think I'd like to hear about is there's one thing in trying to work on all of the attendant issues with people who are experiencing homelessness, and there's another thing about the enforcement of ordinances. So you've got the rule of law, you've got to enforce the rule of law. So are there lessons that you have seen from other cities where the current ordinances might be weaker than stronger, or some other cities have had these similar ordinances, and because they didn't do something, they ended up in a bad place? I think this is on a lot of people's minds, you know, like how do you, I think people are afraid that if we start on this road and we don't do the right thing, we're going to end up in the wrong place. So how do we start to, you know, mesh these two, your information gathering and Chief Manley, what you have to do with the ordinances, maybe both of you can answer. Okay, I'm sorry.
So that's better. when we're looking at ordinances and what should be implemented moving forward, I think, again, I like what you'd said in the front end of policies can be amended. And I think as we're trying to find the right answers, this is the initial revised ordinances that we're working with. But I think that there's always opportunity to amend ordinances moving forward. I don't know that we've seen a city that has, and the chief might have some examples that he can think of, but I can't think of a city that I'd point to say this is a sample ordinance that we'd like to implement. But I think, as the chief pointed out, this is very new. This is in the past 3 weeks, and I think that's what we're going to be looking to. I do also think that when we look at cities and their ordinances, it's not a cookie cutter. Each city has their unique set of ordinances. So, like what I was talking about more of the policy side, we would look to those ordinances, and part of some ordinances in some cities might work and be something that we'd like to bring back to Austin.
Yeah, I don't have a specific city. I think one of the things, too, is it's specific community to community. You know, our point in time count was roughly 2,200 folks that were homeless at the time we took that count. And when you look at some of the cities I know that are dealing with these issues as well, they may be, you know, 9-fold, 15-fold greater than what we have here in Austin. So the solution for Austin will be very specific to the conditions here in Austin and really to the Austin community and who steps up and helps fill in some of the gaps here. But again, our role will be is working with the ordinances that we're given in those instances where we're either called to service or where officers come upon something on their own and take action.
Well, sometimes when you're looking at new policy, you think about, okay, I'm seeing a red flag. I'm seeing a sign that something may not be going the way we need it to go. So that's what I'm trying to get at. What are some of the things the community needs to be thinking about that if we see things, now if we're on a trajectory or an arc to make this all better, are there certain things we should be looking at, and anyone can answer this, that would show us that maybe we need to, you know, sit back and think about things and think about adjusting what we're doing?
Well, I think some of it is just what everybody sees, you know, each day, driving around Austin, walking around downtown, and what do you see that's different today than it was a month ago? And, you know, I know the observations of our officers, just very similar to you all, will be we are seeing people camping in places where maybe they weren't camping before, or they're camping in much greater numbers under bridges, or they have much more elaborate setups with more permanent type fixtures such as mattresses and things like that. So I think these are the things that we have to pay attention to because this is something that's different. We're looking at the data, again, for the calls for service that we're getting on not only on calls where the person who is believed to be homeless at that time is being called on, but also where they're the ones calling for actions that maybe somebody took against them. So we have to pay a fine balance. I talked earlier about the social media and about how people, you know, they're just on extremes on this. You know, we're seeing extremes on people's either opinions or actions towards the homeless as well, and that does not bode for community safety also. So we're paying attention to all of these things for us that indicate public safety issues could be arising, or just what these changes have done to overall community safety?
So I would add to that, I think that as we're implementing the ordinances, as we're moving forward, and this was true before the ordinances were amended, we need to identify places for people to go. The importance to all of this discussion is we need to be looking for housing solutions for individuals who are experiencing homelessness. As we're looking at how these ordinances come into play, it's helpful for us to provide the resources to an individual. And that could mean, as you mentioned, it could mean a individual just needs help with one rent. But it could mean something more than that. And we need to meet an individual where they're at in order to provide them the services they need to be successful in having housing.
I think it's important to acknowledge once again, the ordinances are tools that the police department has, but they don't solve for homelessness. We certainly don't want to become a downtown or a city where our citizens are walking past people who are laid out on a sidewalk, and we see it every day downtown. And by the way, we saw it before the ordinances changed. We see it to a higher degree today than we did before. But do we want to become a city where we walk by people not even thinking whether they might be dead or dying or in distress? I think it's important that people still have a mind for being observant and making the call when they think that something just doesn't feel or look right. So I think that to now hesitate and assume that nothing can or will be done based on what your perceptions are of a particular situation out on the street, it's important to remember that if something just doesn't look or feel right, we've got to make that call. Let 911 call taker be the judge of what resources need to be deployed, EMS, APD, and put it in their hands. Don't try to make the determination is an emergency or not. And that's a really hard call for people. I mean, every single day we're seeing people laid out. Are they passed out and asleep? Are they passed out because of some substance? Or are they in distress? And especially this time of year, it's really hard to make that judgment call. So I think sometimes we just have to err on the side of the individual's safety. But I think we have to keep a mind for what kind of community we are and want to continue to be. And that is a place that we're looking after everybody's needs and safety, not just our own or some other person because of their class or not.
So that sounds great. I'm just trying to think of somebody who has to implement this and thinking about the community where you have differences of opinion or differences of a subjective opinion. For example, a transgression. So somebody comes up to somebody and they would say, you know, you're in my space, and another person may be okay with that. You know, so you've got a lot of very complicated things going on here, and we've got a community from what we're hearing here that is really engaged in this, is concerned about this, wants to find solutions to this. And, you know, I'm trying to come down to, like, what are the absolute necessary things that we need as a community to relieve some of the people who are experiencing homelessness? And where do we start? And then how do we keep going? Because people really want to see concrete things that are not just in the enforcement of the ordinances, but using what you and your officers see, Chief Manley, and also Veronica, what the city is thinking about in terms of homes and shelters and temporary, and also Bill, what you're saying. I mean, how do we bring this all I think everybody's trying to figure out, how do you bring this together so that we can start solving problems, even if it's just starting with the low-hanging fruit? This is what we're trying to get at, I think.
Well, I think we need that comprehensive solution. We need to be talking about all of the components. We've done away with some of the ordinances that we used, but we don't have the full fleshed out plan yet. So that's what we need to focus on, is when we talk about housing is very important, but it needs to be supported housing. It needs to be housing that's, let's face it, we know we have individuals that are homeless that don't have the ability to live on their own in a home, even if it was provided. So we have to make sure we've got all of those support services in place to help those individuals so that we don't just put them in a home that they're going to be out of in a week or 2 weeks and back on the street. So it's having that whole comprehensive plan. It's having a plan to address the individuals that do not want to be housed, that there are some that are homeless by choice. They just prefer that lifestyle. So whatever plan we come up with has to be able to address that as well. And where is that going to be acceptable? Where is that not going to be acceptable? And then we have to settle in on what role do we want law enforcement to play in those times when there are future violations. Once we've come up with this plan, we've housed individuals, we've got places for those to stay that want to stay in the public space, what do we want the response to be from law enforcement for those people that violate once we get to that point?
And so I would agree with that. I think we have an adopted plan to end homelessness. The city council adopted it recently in the past couple of years, and we are working towards putting the meat, if you will, to that plan, or the implementation part of that plan. I think it is a complex issue that requires a lot of solutions and different solutions. To the chief's point, and I think I said it previously, we're looking at meeting people where they're at in that spectrum of finding housing. And housing doesn't necessarily mean a house. It could be emergency shelter. It could be rental assistance. But looking at how we work together to provide those resources. One of the things that we as a community have done, and it is important for us to work together as a community, we have done things like solved homelessness for veterans, and I think that's a huge kudos to our city, and something I hear about that we've done as a community from other cities as a best practice. We also have focused on reducing youth homelessness, and in the past year we've reduced youth homelessness in half. So that it's a testament. I know that's not the complete answer, but it's a testament to what we can do as a community when we work together and provide the resources, leverage the resources we have together to work towards those solutions.
I think it's unfortunate that a lot of the successes that we have getting people housed, ending their condition of homelessness, go unknown. The fact of the matter is that we see an increasing number of people coming into a condition of homelessness in Austin every year. That number keeps going up and up and up. And our homeless management information system would show that that number is approaching about 8,000 people a year who have some touch point of some homeless service. The healthcare district numbers show closer to 10,000 people that they've identified as being homeless in a given year. What I think is interesting is that the one-night count numbers remain relatively flat. 2,255 January of this year, 5% increase over last year. If you look at the 10-year low point, however, which was 2015, we've increased 23% overall since then and 63% unsheltered. We've opened virtually no new shelter beds since Arch opened in 2004. That's not sufficient. We need shelters around the city. City Council has taken steps directing the manager to come back with recommendations on where that will be. And while I've said earlier, I think that we need more support across the entire homeless service spectrum, a lot of our focus and attention as a community has been on housing first, permanent housing. That's a very expensive modality. It's in short supply. We have a 95% apartment occupancy rate. There are a few units available. It's a lessor's market. And so getting new units online takes a long time. That means people are languishing on the streets for extended periods of time, and yet we don't have more shelter beds. We need more shelter now. That shelter needs to be temporary, where people move through it, not to it. It needs to be housing focused, where they have a game plan and case management and supports to help end their condition of homelessness. The fact that 54% of our homeless population have been identified as being chronically homeless represents 30% more than the national average. That's telling me that our people are languishing on the streets too long while they're waiting for that time that they get housed, and in the meantime, don't have adequate places to be. Wouldn't it be best if they didn't have to camp on the street or sleep on the street? We hear the number one concern of the homeless outreach street team host. We hear from other service providers, the police department, EMS. We have nowhere to tell people to go. Police encounter someone as they respond to an issue involving homelessness. The person says, if I can't be here, where can I go? And for too long, the answer has been, go to Arch. Well, we've seen what Arch has become because it's the only place, and because we've let it get a little bit out of control as far as drugs and other things going on there. That should be changing. City Council efforts led by Councilmember Tovo, in fact, have led to a change in the scope of work there that will be in full effect in October. But we can't forget that that's, in and of itself, is not the answer. Basic services. Where can someone use a restroom, a shower, a computer, a locker? Storage is a major concern. We don't have enough services. It's our belief, however, that we need more shelter where people can be, and that has to be temporary, where they move through it, not to it, until such time that they can be housed. Otherwise, we're going to be on a treadmill endlessly, and we will never be able to keep up with it. We'll have more people coming into the condition. We'll never have enough money. We'll never have enough housing. And the fact of the matter is, too, National Alliance to End Homelessness has been to Austin many times in the last 2 years to help lead and guide us through a lot of conversations around rescope for the arch and what is needed here. And I will tell you that this national think tank body is rather loath to suggest to communities like ours that you open more shelter. When they looked at our numbers, when they see the significant increase we've had in unsheltered homelessness in the last 5 years, they say you need more shelter. You've got to get in front of the problem before it gets more ahead of you. So more shelter now is absolutely needed, but it can't be the dead end that Arch has been for a long time. You've got to be able to move people through it, not to it. Again, this takes a unified effort among the community, a lot of support, and a lot of hard choices. We hear constantly complaints about people being homeless where they are. June 20th city council meeting was interesting in many different ways. Council made a lot of hard decisions that night. One of the decisions they made was to purchase a building in South Central Austin to open a new shelter. And person after there were a lot of people that came to the microphone and spoke in favor of it. There were probably more who spoke against it. What I think is interesting, and we hear that beyond that conversation, is complaints about people who are homeless. We don't like them. We're afraid of them. They're causing this problem, the camps, the human waste, whatever. We don't want it there. But then we also hear, but we don't want that shelter. We don't want the permanent supportive housing near us either. No one can have it both ways. We've got to make hard choices as a community. I live in Allendale. We've got people that live in Northwest Park, that camp and live in Shoal Creek, and other areas in my neighborhood who are homeless. I would much rather have those folks housed or in a place where they're safe, where it's safer for my kids and other people's kids to run around the park and feel confident that they're not going to run into a needle, human waste, or some other situation. These are important and difficult decisions that we have to make because we can't rely on law enforcement. The ordinances are just a small part of this. We need more shelter, and we need more support across the housing spectrum.
So I think we know what we need. I mean, I'm hearing we know what we need. So how are we going to go from what we need to what to get what we need? This is the big question, I think, in everyone's mind. So you put in, I think, Bill, you've talked about some of the tensions and perceptions of, you know, not in my backyard, or I'm nervous about this, but at the same time, I don't want my children walking down the street and seeing someone in a tent. And what I think people are stuck. Like, what do we do about it? I don't think people would disagree with what people said here. They might. But I think the big thing is, now what? What do you do, and how do you keep it going, and how do you get the momentum, and how do you inform people so that they can put away some of their biases or their perceptions? How do we get started here? I think this is what we're going to be trying to do, especially when we have the implementation of the ordinances as well as the city plan and how the plan is going to progress, and that what, you know, the Austin Alliance is going to do in terms of helping us understand this.
Thanks. If my arm were longer, I would have taken it away from Angela before she was done talking. We need an actionable plan. It was acknowledged earlier in the conversation tonight that council adopted an action plan to end homelessness. That was in April of 2018. That plan, as viewed by the business community, is not an actionable plan. It doesn't necessarily prioritize what has to happen first. Where's the money come from? How will it be spent? It says we need $30 million a year, more than the roughly $30 million that we're already spending from local taxpayer dollars, federal funding, and other sources. You put that in front of a person, and by the way, we are hearing from a lot of people within the business community saying, we're willing to do our part, but we need an actionable plan. And I will tell you, government cannot solve this. The city cannot solve this problem. The city of Austin plays a critical role, as do the nonprofit sector organizations. Downtown Austin Alliance has been pitching, advocating for policy, funding housing projects, helping to test initiatives, leading collaborations. It takes a lot more than that, but it does take an actionable plan. I would say that between the ECHO action plan, between a lot of groundwork that was laid by former interim assistant city manager Sarah Hensley and all city departments involved in formulating recommendations that were made to council, some of which are being acted upon, by the way. Research that we have funded that has been led by frontline social service provider agencies saying, here is what we need. The number one thing, people are saying that folks who are experiencing homelessness do not know where to go for what they need, and in many cases don't even know what they need. I would say that has a lot to do with behavioral health issues, where even if they think they need help, they don't know where to go. People don't know where to go for what they need. They're not buying what we're selling when we say go to ARCH. That's not sufficient. They don't believe in the system that we have. The community does not believe that what's happening is working because of what we see when we look outside of our doors most days. People who are experiencing homelessness also don't believe in the system. They've submitted coordinated assessment a year ago, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, six times, three times, and they don't hear anything. There's a lack of faith among people experiencing homelessness that the system really works for them. So we need a consolidated plan, and I believe we've got different pieces of that plan in different documents that need to come together. This is one of the key elements of Resolution 184 from June 20th that directs the manager to come back with that plan, among many other things. But until we have an actionable plan that we can all agree to, that then identifies, here's the role the private sector plays: leadership, funding, coordination, support, the role of the nonprofits providing the services, the role of the city helping to organize and orchestrate. Until we have that, we'll still be on that treadmill.
So I think that we've taken some really strong steps in that direction. I think the purchase of the potential new shelter was a good step in that regard. I would add, I think it's important that we fill the existing shelter space that we have. The Salvation Army has a new shelter coming online for families, which is an important part of our homeless community that we provide shelter to. And I would encourage us as a community to look at those options. The City of Austin does provide shelter with the ARCH, as well as the potential new shelter that we're in the process of purchasing. But there are many shelters. There's a strong shelter system in our city, and I would encourage us as a community to support those nonprofits that are providing that shelter service as well. The purchase of the property in South Austin was a step towards providing more shelter. When we're looking at best practices, we're seeing that a shelter space should not just be located in one part of the city. It should be geographically dispersed throughout, and it should be smaller in size. So I think we're going to have conversations about, is there additional shelter space needed? And if so, what parts of the city should we go to? We're looking at where individuals who are homeless are located, where there's good access to health care, to transportation, to the services that an individual who is homeless needs. And we're looking at our whole shelter system becoming a shelter system that starts that conversation on the front end about getting an individual back into housing. We want to make sure that when an individual becomes homeless, that is a rare occurrence, that it is brief, and that it's not reoccurring. So that mantra is going to be throughout our shelter system. The ARCH continues to be revamped, and that was through the leadership of our city council. We want to make sure that the city shelter is providing case management to everybody who's in the ARCH. We want to set up our guests at the ARCH for success. And so that discussion that you're hearing with the new shelter is also going to be at the ARCH. It is going to be looking at working with individuals as soon as they come in the door to make sure that we're talking about how do we get you the services that you need so that you can be housed successfully long term. But again, I urge us as a community to look at the existing shelter system, and not only are we looking at additional shelter space and other solutions, but we need to look at the shelters we have in place and making sure that they're fully at capacity and that our nonprofit community has the resources they need to do so.
And the only thing I'll touch on, part of your question, you talked about maybe misperceptions of homeless. And I think that, you know, I'll look at Chief Newsom and many of his officers over there who spend much time out on the streets talking to the homeless individuals, understanding how they ended up where they ended up. And the reasons are as wide as the backgrounds in this room. We have some folks that are there because they made poor choices in their earlier life, and maybe they got involved in crime and drugs and they haven't been able to get out of that cycle. We have some that are there by choice. We have some that are there dealing with mental health issues. We have some that just had that tragic occurrence in their life where they just kind of fell out of touch with mainstream society. So the reasons why the homeless community is homeless are, again, as varied as the backgrounds in this room. And again, it takes the work that our officers do that get out there and know these folks, and the efforts that we do through the host team, that those that we have the ability to help, to link with services. Sometimes it's as simple as an individual doesn't have an ID, so they can't go apply for benefits or they can't go apply for a job, but they don't understand how the system works and how to get that ID, and we can link them with those services. And then, of course, some of them are much more complicated than that, and that's what's going to be involved in the larger discussion.
So, Bill, I want to get back to you in terms of the ambassadors and what the ambassadors are seeing in the last month or so, but I also want to ask a question or get your thinking about, we've heard about, number one, this is what we need. You know, we understand what we need. We understand what the problem is. We've made some inroads into this problem, and I'm just trying to figure out how do we take all of the knowledge and the skills and the expertise and the data that all of you have individually and coordinate that. I mean, how do we put that together and say, okay, we understand the police are on the street, they've talked to people, they know their situation, and how many referrals we go to, you know, for something like a medical. But how do we put this all together so that the plan, when we have that plan lays it all out and all of those different sources of information come to bear? That was the first question. Second question is, all the people here are really interested in this issue, or they wouldn't be here on a hot night. And how do they get involved? Where do you see them making a difference in this problem? How could they fit into this?
So as far as the role of our ambassadors, the downtown ambassadors, red shirts, Downtown Austin Alliance logo, we have about 40 team members who are on the streets every day. Just about around the clock, but from 6 a.m. to midnight most days, we've got teams of people who are cleaning the streets, picking up litter, addressing human waste, addressing camps, what we're seeing, what they're seeing. And by the way, they're quantifying what they're seeing by collecting data, which we don't have yet. Again, to Brian's point, we've had the change in ordinances for 3 weeks now, and so we don't have any trends certainly yet to share with you. What we are seeing, and it's not surprising, I think, to anyone, more people sitting, lying, sleeping, camping on our streets in downtown Austin. It's visible. More people sleeping in our parks. We've managed Republic Square since it reopened after reconstruction in 2017, October, from sometimes two or none sleeping in the park at night. We're probably closer to 18 to 20 every night now. We're seeing, as Chief addressed earlier, furniture, larger camps, more stuff on the streets. What's interesting in my mind is to wonder, well, these people didn't all of a sudden just drop into Austin. Where did they come from? So, apparently they've been living in the shadows in the past when these behaviors were considered illegal. Now they're front and center. We're seeing increased amounts of human waste, of litter, of food waste, of other things that you would expect to find where people have been living out on the streets. In terms of the plan, I think that, as I mentioned earlier, there have been a lot of different planning efforts going on. The ECHO action plan, which has already begun to inform council's actions. And by the way, we can't sit and wait and not do anything, and there have been a lot of steps taken while we're trying to get a solid plan in place that everyone can agree to and buy into that defines different roles. So I think taking a hard look at what is there, coming to grips with, okay, how do we consolidate these, prioritize the work, and then put something into action that we can then call upon the private sector and say, here's your role. This is where we need your leadership, your support. That takes, I think, a heavy load off of the other side. You know, the city can't do it all themselves. I think to a great extent, a lot of us have looked at the city to say, what are you doing? How can you fix this? And so it requires more than that. We've seen the greatest successes in other cities, projects like Haven for Hope, Miami's Chapman Partnership, other initiatives that are led by private sector folks, led with funding, led with private sector carrying the banner, bringing the community behind them, helping to lead efforts. And I think that's what's needed here. We've got the makings of it. We need to coalesce it, pull it together, and move forward. Well, I think that, again, we need the key leadership in the room to make that happen. Representation from private, nonprofit, and public sector together to say, here's where we are, what else is needed in order to inform where we go from here, make those decisions, move ahead.
And I think part of that coordination and that discussion, we need to look at opportunities for that, what that mechanism would look like, whether it's a particular governing council or a council of the leadership in our community to help us with that direction. I would add to what Bill said. I think I've been in this role for a few months now. There is a lot of coordinating going on within the nonprofit community, in the faith-based community, in the business community, but I think it's bringing all the people that are working in this world together to start having a better coordinated effort. One of the things that City Council did is create the Homeless Strategy Office. When Council identified this as their top priority, they showed their commitment by creating the position of the Homeless Strategy Officer. And that's just one role in the coordination that we're talking, but it's an important first step. And it's an important move to make sure that we're all coming to the table. And I would take that, we talk about the city, nonprofit sector, business community, but I also think it's other governmental entities. We also have Travis County, we have AISD, we have our state government, our federal government that have a role in this as well. And I think we as a community need to bring individuals from all levels of government and non-governmental entities to have that conversation. And you asked what people can do to help. I think there's people are doing a lot to help. Austin's a very generous community and a very benevolent community, and I'm thankful for that. But I think there's more to come as we convene this group and have that leadership codified, I guess is a good way to say it. You'll see more from us on ways that as individuals can help. In the meantime, I think having honest conversations, talking about what it means to be an individual who's experiencing homelessness, humanizing that discussion. And to Bill's point, as we're talking about providing homeless services in every neighborhood in Austin, talking about the importance of that and the importance of providing services to neighbors that we have in our city.
Homelessness is not a new issue that we've talked about in this community, and it's not the first time our council has acted. As we've talked about, there have been plans. We've seen great examples with what Alan Graham has done and other community leaders have done. But I think that regardless of your position on the issue, we've got 400 people in the room today. So there is an energy behind this. There is an importance behind this. And I think if we find ourselves a year from now not having made any progress from this point, then shame on all of us. So you ask, what does it take? I think this is part of what it takes. You know, regardless of what people think about why we're here, it's definitely got everyone's attention right now. And I think the focus is front and center. Council has identified this as the number one priority. We've created the position for our homeless executive that's going to take lead on this. And I think with the support of the community, and it's been said already, whatever role that you can play, whether it's just voicing your opinion, attending council meetings, attending neighborhood meetings, or if you're a philanthropist looking for opportunities to give back and support programs that will help us either house or treat folks, I think that that's going to be a very important step as we work towards this.
I have two more questions, and then I think we'll take the questions from the audience. So one question I have is, what are you most worried about, number one? And then, is there a question I didn't ask you that you'd like to answer before we go into, you know, the audience, okay? So what are you most worried about, and what would you like to say that you didn't have an opportunity to say in this engagement?
Well, it probably will be no surprise to anybody that my biggest concern is public safety, and that's everyone in the community, and that is that we don't get so tied down to the rhetoric or the extreme positions or all of the rants that are... It's definitely got everyone's attention right now, and I think the focus is front and center. Council has identified this as the number one priority. We've created the position for our homeless executive that's going to take lead on this, and I think with the support of the community, and it's been said already, whatever role that you can play, whether it's just voicing your opinion, attending council meetings, attending neighborhood meetings, or if you're a philanthropist looking for opportunities to give back and support programs that will help us either house or treat folks, I think that that's going to be a very important step as we work towards this.
I have two more questions, and then I think we'll take the questions from the audience. So One question I have is, what are you most worried about? Number one. And then, is there a question I didn't ask you that you'd like to answer before we go in to, you know, the audience, okay? So what are you most worried about, and what would you like to say that, you didn't have an opportunity to say in this engagement?
Well, it probably will be no surprise to anybody that my biggest concern is public safety, and that's everyone in the community, and that is that we don't get so tied down to the rhetoric or the extreme positions or all of the rants that are going on about the issue, because at the end of the day, we have to realize that these are human beings on the under end of this issue that we're talking about, and we've got to come together with a solution that meets everyone's needs, that addresses the quality of life issues for both the residents and the business owners, but that also addresses the needs for the homeless, and that it be done in a constructive, productive way, and that we don't see any negative outcomes, injuries, things like that, as a result of some of the rhetoric that's going on.
My biggest worry is our discussion tonight. It's individuals who are experiencing homelessness. It does keep me up at night in terms of, it is such a complex issue, and are we... I know that we have the ability to provide the resources that we need to bring the people to the table to make the right decisions and the leadership in place to do so. But it is a very human issue, and when you're exposed to it on a daily basis and working with individuals who are experiencing homelessness, it's something that doesn't leave you easily. And so I think that it's something that's constant on my mind, on making sure that we have the resources in place to truly address the issue.
What I'm most concerned about, and what sometimes literally keeps me up at night, is that we become Seattle, Portland, LA, places where we hear and see, where we hear and see horrible videos and stories from things happening in those communities. I have had people send me countless times, hundreds of times, the Seattle is dying link. I don't want Austin to become that. We've got to get in front of this. One of my greatest concerns is that managing the problem to the extent that we have it today requires tremendous time, energy, resources that I think we have to recognize. We have to devote as much, if not more, time to how we prevent homelessness from happening in the future. Because I will tell you, we are absolutely on the same trajectory as the other cities that I just mentioned in terms of their economies, the nature of business, and what's happening in Austin is very similar to those other cities. So how do we come up with a strategy to prevent people from becoming homeless? Just an example of that. It was about a year and a half ago. I was riding home with my wife, turned up the radio. She looked at me kind of funny. There was an NPR spot, a story about L.A. And the story was saying that for every 5% increase in rent in the city and county of Los Angeles, they would expect to see 2,000 more people become homeless. 5% increase in rent, 2,000 more people become homeless in a city where there's over 40,000 people experiencing homeless, 50,000 already. It made me wonder at that very moment, what's the equation here? For a 5% increase in Austin's rent, how many more people become homeless? How do we prevent that? What is the factor that we can say, let's keep you in that place where you're living so that the worst thing doesn't happen? So while we're managing the problem, we've got to take care of that. I didn't probably respond effectively enough to the prior question about community involvement. Churches like to come down and feed people, service organizations. Is that really the best thing to do? Until we can define a role better, more clearly for organizations like that, they'll continue to do what they have to do. But I believe if we're able to lay it out differently to say, here's a better way to spend your time, your volunteer time, and your energy that is really more effective at helping to address the problem, that they'll do that. I'll share with you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I was at the Front Steps annual luncheon fundraiser. Front Steps, for those of you that may not know, manages the Arch facility just down the street from us here. And while they were about to ask the audience to pull out their credit card, take the envelope on the table, they also said, I probably should announce this right now, but we've already exceeded our goal for the year. Everybody kind of had a funny look on their face, and they proceeded to tell us a story about a 20-year-old kid who was in the audience that day, who is a Minecraft guru and has a following online. I don't know much about Minecraft. But while he was sitting wherever he was playing Minecraft one evening and had a bag of peanuts in his lap, this is a true story, he decided to try to start selling peanuts to donate money to Front Steps. And in the course of several hours, playing Minecraft, saying, okay, here's the next peanut, who's the highest bidder, raised $20,000. $20,000 like that. You all know as well as I do, and I've been trying to figure out how do we harness the energy, the power that our growing technology minds bring to us. The very people that are filling your offices, your apartments, our condos, coming here in droves, believe me, have the wherewithal that I don't to do things like that. And I think we need to harness that because that's a huge untapped resource that can help to figure out planning, raise funds, and do many other things. We talk about not having a coordinated system, a real-time system where people, if they want or need services, including the service providers, when a person's in front of them, being able to go in and say, you need a shelter bed? Here's real-time data on where that is. Case manager, got it right there. Other things, clothes, other resources, this. We don't have that. We've got a city full of people that could probably do that overnight. So there is a role for that untapped resource that I think will advance us exponentially faster to a much better place.
So I think what we heard tonight are a lot of not only perceptions and things that we can do, but also, you know, Bill, the last thing you said is really an important thing. First of all, it's not just a public problem. It's a private problem. It's a nonprofit problem. It's our problem. And the second thing you said, and all of you are saying, is you really got to think creatively about doing this. You know, how do you bring other creative solutions to this problem that aren't necessarily the traditional way that governments work? Or even, you know, profits or nonprofits work. So I think that's really an important thing to say. And as we said at the very beginning of this, this tension is something that we always experience in a democratic government. I know we're really trying to figure out how to make these both work to the best advantage when either side is not totally right, and we have to protect the minority while we, you know, look at the majority and help them as well. So this is really important. What I'm going to do now is read some questions that came from you. And the questions are addressed to individuals. So this is to the chief or Veronica or both. Why not provide homeless places to sleep before changing the ordinance?
Well, there's a role that both Veronica and I play, and that is when these decisions are being made by our mayor and council, our role is to inform them of the implications of the decisions, and that's what was done in this instance. We informed that under the current ordinances, I know for myself speaking to council, under the current ordinances, this is how we use them, this is how we enforce them, and this was kind of the numbers, highlighting the fact that this issue of excessive arrests and citations really isn't what we saw in the data. But at the end of the day, we are a democratically elected government, and our elected officials make these decisions, and then it's our role to enforce them, to educate, and to work with them if there are changes that need to be made.
I would agree with the chief. I think when we're looking at our role, it is on the implementation side and looking at the change in the ordinances, making sure that we have alternatives for people to go other than our streets, and that's what we're doing. In this capacity, we've been doing for a long time now, and we'll continue to do so moving forward.
Bill, this is for you. What solutions can you immediately, this is underlined, implement to help businesses with homeless camping in front of their businesses?
I don't have a solution. That's flat out honest. I don't. I would say, at such time you perceive there is a condition or an event or an incident happening outside of your place of work, your property, your residence, that you believe crosses a threshold, needing that 911 call, you make it. You err on the side of safety, both for yourselves, your tenants, or residents, and the person who may well be in distress without us knowing it.
And if I can just add one point to that as well, we are a data-driven police department. We've got business intelligence tools that we use to track when crime occurs, where it occurs, everything that we can do. And that's how we do a lot of our deployment strategies, is based on where the data tells us crime is occurring. And so as it is with when we talk about burglaries of vehicles and people don't always report it because they don't think that it'll be investigated, or a theft or something, if you don't report it and we don't know about it, we don't have accurate data on what's actually happening. So I mentioned earlier that we're going to efforts to collect data so that we understand the impact of these changes. And so those calls are very important to us. And I think, excuse me, it's worth highlighting, if your perception is that someone's health or safety is in immediate danger, then that's the 911 call. If it's just that you're trying to report conduct that does not rise to that level, then call 311. But whichever you choose, we can't collect the data if you don't make the call.
This is probably an opportune time to make the statement that we shouldn't take matters into our own hands. We've seen recent news where people have confronted people because they think their behaviors are inappropriate. Making the call to 911, keeping yourself safe, keeping others safe, is the right approach. Trying to take matters into your own hands and approaching someone, directing them to do anything, arguing, creating something that didn't need to happen, is unnecessary. There's still no place for hate in this equation. Don't put yourself in that position in potential jeopardy. Bad things can happen. We all know it. Unintended consequences can occur. Make the call, even if it takes time for the police to arrive, longer than you think. And by the way, these calls oftentimes are very low priority calls. It's based on what that 911 call taker is hearing, what's been described to them. We're asking you to report things truthfully, not to try and ratchet up the priority of the call. But, based on other activity that the police department is dealing with at any given time, it may take longer than you think it should for the police to respond. Don't take matters into your own hands. Keep yourselves safe. Stay out of it. Allow the proper response authority to address the issue. Don't try to do it yourself.
This question's for you, Chief. How do you plan on mitigating the increase in petty theft crimes as a result of the new city ordinances? This is an assumption that there is an increase, but anyway, this is the question.
Well, you somewhat answered it for me a little bit. We have to first establish that there is an increase, and that's, again, why we collect all the data. And what we would do is, just as we do when there's an uptick in any type of crime, we will try and determine what that root cause is, and if this assumption or if this assertion here were to be accurate, that we're seeing those increases, then we would put a strategy together with whatever available time we had to address that. Realizing, and Bill kind of touched on this before, everything we do is based on prioritization. The calls that we receive are categorized from a P0, which means life is in immediate danger and officers are going to be running lights and sirens to get there, down through the P1s, 2s, and 3s as far as those that are not immediately threatening life or property and those where just a report needs to be taken. So we talk often about staffing levels in this community and about the need for officers, and so I just like to make sure there are realistic expectations on what we can and can't do. However, if we did identify an issue with increases in crime related to this, then it is something that we would pay attention to and look to put together a strategy to address that. If it was targeting a specific business or a specific part of Austin, then we would look to put together some type of initiative, time allowing, and not having more serious crime patterns.
Veronica, this is for you. What does the city plan to do about the litter, hygiene, and neighborhood health?
We are continuously looking at how we make sure that we have a clean community, not only for all our residents, and that includes individuals that are homeless. We do have a number of contracts that we administer to perform cleanups where common encampments are under our underpasses. We also have a strong cleanup component of our watershed protection department that goes to our watershed areas where we have a lot of encampments and make sure that we have a clean environment. We also have in our parks department a component of cleanup as well. We will continue to do so. We will make sure that we are providing those services if there's in areas where it is needed. And I would add, I mentioned the pilot program we have with the litter program, and it's a small program, but when you think about an encampment, you think about an individual that's homeless, they're just like us. They don't want to live in an environment that is dirty as well. So it's very preliminary, but we're seeing some success with that and seeing individual encampments provide their own cleaning up and providing those bags out for us to pick up as well. So again, it's a complex issue, requires different levels of resources and support and solutions as we're addressing the issue.
Maybe what you can do is if you can submit it. I'm just trying to get through people who, you know, did it the right way by asking the question on the card. We have a lot of questions here, so we're running out of time. So this is for Bill. Bill, why is Arch downtown? Are there plans to build additional shelters or improve existing facility? We touched this a little bit. This may have been written before, you know, we actually spoke. So if you want to enhance your answer, and Veronica, you may want to.
So I moved to Austin shortly before Arch opened, but after it was planned for to be at the location where it is. It's my understanding that there was another site that was a possibility to have it until word leaked out that that's where it might go, and the community erupted, kind of what I was talking about earlier. So in downtown, there's no zoning that can prohibit that, as there is in other parts of the city. Apparently, it was a deal that was able to be worked out to put the facility there. There are steps being taken right now. I touched on this earlier, to create more shelter. Action taken June 20 to purchase a building. Veronica led a lot of the legwork on making that happen, to open a new shelter in South Central Austin, 50 to 100 beds, a housing-focused shelter. City Council across the dais, it was a very interesting conversation, said this won't be the last. There need to be more, and there need to be more in each council district. And so Resolution 184 from that same evening talked about that very piece of the puzzle, that facet, where there needs to be that conversation about putting shelter in every council district. What's needed is hard to say. It's not necessarily a one-to-one ratio. Any given night, we have about 1,100 unsheltered people. It's not to say you need 1,100 units necessarily. If your shelters are working effectively the way they should, people are moving through them, not to them, then it's something maybe less than that. But unquestionably, we need more shelter, and we need more than just what's downtown. An interesting tidbit, it was touched on earlier, the Rathgeber Center, a new family, women and children's shelter, this structure's built, capital campaign was successful, can't open. There aren't operating funds sufficient to open it. So we've got a building sitting there waiting to operate. City's looking for money to help contribute to that. We've got women and children and some complete families staying in the Salvation Army's downtown shelter. The worst possible environment for a child ever. And yet we've got a facility that we're trying to bolster up and open. It's a good example of where do we need private sector support and juice behind something that could get moving quickly. If we were able to do that, the shelter beds down here could be repurposed. We could provide case management to more single men, more single women, which is a desperate need, and improve the efficiency of what we have today. So I think there's a look at not only how do we create more shelter, pardon me, a need to look at not only how we create more shelter, but how we make the shelters that we have today operate more effectively. That has everything to do with the rescope of the Arch facility and something like what I was just talking about in terms of Salvation Army.
If I could add to the piece about the Arch, my understanding that decision-making also included, having it in a location that is close to other social services. So there's Caritas across the street, there's the Salvation Army nearby as well. Also looking for a location that was accessible, so downtown is accessible to all parts of town by mass transit and so forth. So I did work for the city at the time, and I remember that being part of the discussion.
This question, I think, is on everyone's mind. How difficult is it going to be to provide needed shelter and services while the city is experiencing continued budget pressures, including the upcoming revenue increase cap of 3.5% mandated by the state next year? You have the answer to this, you know, the magic bullet on this, but this is the big question.
It'll be difficult, but I think that we are, I know that we are looking at unique funding solutions. I go back to, you know, there's things that we can do as a city, and we are, because of the revenue cap overall as a city, we're looking at how we do business and how can we do it better or at less of a cost, and we will continue to do so. This is our top priority as a city, and so that means we know that it's going to require the resources needed to fund it. So looking at unique financing that we can do as a city, but then also I go back to that discussion of the broader community and looking at how we leverage resources beyond the city of Austin and what mechanism does that look like as we are moving forward in that direction.
So I've said it a number of times already. This is where the private sector clearly can play a role, needs to play a role. Government can't solve it all for us. Government plays a critical role. But there are other sources. We've seen Houston substantially increase the amount of annual funding that they get from HUD through their continuum of care grant. If we are focused in our planning in the right ways, there's an opportunity that we can generate more dollars from sources like that. So I'll go back to, if we have a plan that's actionable, that we can literally stand up in front of folks in the community, the growing philanthropic community that we have here in Austin, I think we will see increasing support from the private sector to bolster up where we may fall short due to current funding coming through the city.
This one is addressed to the chief, but I'm not sure that, well, we'll just ask the question. What is being done to keep the rules from affecting tourism? I think people are worried that people won't come or they'll have a negative experience, especially in the district where most people will be. So this question is about that. So I'm going to give it to you.
Well, I don't know that I have obviously a direct answer of how we work in tourism specific. I think what this, again, is using the ordinances that we have, doing everything we can do to keep the community safe, but making sure that we collect complete and accurate data. That's why the reporting is important, so that if we're seeing upticks in whether it's criminal activity, whether it's quality of life issues, that we can address that. Because I agree. I think that if those were to increase and we were to see the area around the convention center and those areas become problematic in those ways, then we could see hits to the tourism industry, and nobody wants that. So we've got to collect the data so that we can truly understand what's happening, and then we can talk about any necessary changes that could come about if those conditions persist.
Bill, this is for you. How many homeless originate from the Austin area? Is there any evidence suggesting that other cities are actively encouraging their homeless to move to Austin?
This is a question that comes up a lot. I heard a few people chuckle in the audience, but the ECHO data from the annual point-in-time counts demonstrates that 70% roughly of the people who are counted here every year are from Austin, Travis County, or the Central Texas region. We hear a lot about the fact that cities are busing people here. We hear that from our counterparts in other downtown associations and other cities saying, oh yeah, everybody's sending them to us. We can't put our finger to quantify how much that's happening or isn't happening. What the data shows, however, is that roughly 70% of our homeless population is from Austin or Central Texas. They haven't gone far. That being said, Haven for Hope, a 25-acre campus of homeless services that opened in San Antonio in 2010, about a mile and a half outside of the heart of downtown in a relatively light commercial industrial area with tens of co-located services, dormitories, pet care, veteran services, health care, dental, optical, you name it. When Haven for Hope opened in 2010, San Antonio, in fact, started seeing more people turning up in San Antonio saying, oh, here you had this great service provision. element, and they implemented years ago a policy where the first time somebody from out of town checked in at Haven for Hope, they got a card. 9 months after they were there, they were allowed to come, I'll say inside the walls, they probably don't use that term. Part of the facility is what they call a courtyard. Anyone at any time can come there, get a sandwich, take a shower, use a bathroom, even store their medications and their belongings, but be safe in an open air but enclosed, secured area. But in terms of overall services, they weren't allowed to access those until 9 months after they were there. So in fact, people came for something like that. I don't know that we have anything right now that's that good for people to really want to come to Austin if they're experiencing homelessness, because it's so much better here than anywhere else. Chief Newsom will tell you he doesn't think that's the case, that our services might be better than anywhere else, and that therefore people are coming here. But it's a rumor that we hear a lot, suspicion of a lot of people that can't really be quantified other than what I've already shared.
I have three questions that are relatively similar, so I'm going to ask the three of them, and they're all for the chief. The first one, is the homeless population near the University of Texas expanding? Is crime increasing in West Campus due to the homeless? What can the city do to address the concerns of students and parents while still serving the needs of the homeless? So we're talking about that region. Another question, how far north, south, east, and west does the sit-lie ordinance sprawl? And how will the ordinance be enforced on Town Lake? So we're looking at different areas, and I think people are trying to figure out if there's going to be a difference in those areas.
Sure. Sit and lie used to have geographic restrictions, but it is now a citywide sit and lie. And again, keeping in mind that it is in that public space. It's not in that private space. So if you are a homeowner or business owner and it's on your property, that is different. Specific to West Campus, again, we're just a couple, 3 weeks into this, so I don't have information as far as whether there's population shifts among the homeless or anything to give, but it is something that we not only are paying attention to now, but we've always paid attention to West Campus. We have a very strong working relationship with the University of Texas Police Department because obviously that's where jurisdictional lines meet, although we have concurrent jurisdiction. We do focus a lot of our efforts into ensuring the safety of the students, just as we do the rest of Austin. And I hate to keep going back to the same point, but we're data-driven. And so we pay attention to where crimes are reported. And so when we hear things that are happening in West Campus, then that is what we will go over, and we will address that again with whatever strategies will impact that specific incident.
We're almost out of time, so what we're going to do this question is, where can I find the text of the ordinance?
Online. We have it on the City of Austin's website, www.austintexas.gov. There's a link for homelessness, and on that link, not only do we have the text of the ordinances, but we have an FAQ about what the ordinances mean. That website will be a home to the Homeless Strategy Office and will include more information in the future regarding homelessness.
So on behalf of all of you and myself, I really want to thank you for being here tonight, for sharing your insights, for being open-minded, and for being committed to trying to make this work for the city. Thank you.
Angela Dean Evans, thank you very much for moderating tonight. Veronica, Chief Bill, thank you for being here.